Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Will you be my Valentine? You might want to rethink the flowers and candy, though.
I'd rather just stay home.
I just want to watch some football.
Just watch a good movie and have some chocolate.
I've got the truth behind the Valentine's hype, plus how to save the world when drinking a cold one. I've got cooties, and that's a good thing, and a special menu that will put you in the mood for love. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. An amazing seasonal specialty that we get occasionally at farmers markets when we have enough rain is the chanterelle mushroom. And this is a mushroom, it's an orange color. It can grow to be as big as a dinner plate. And Louis Mello, the grower who we're talking to today, actually has a chanterelle mushroom the size of a dinner plate. Nobody knows what to do with it yet. But and this is a phenomenon, according to David Karp, who has just recently written an article about chanterelles, a phenomenon of the California wild oak chanterelle, which only grows between Baja, basically, and the Santa Barbara area. And Louis, you're right in there.
Well, actually, I'm up in San Luis Obispo, but he said they go as far as Arcadia or something like that.
Okay, right, right. And so you have these growing just wild on your property. You're on a hillside.
Yes.
And they grow underneath the oak leaves. How do you find them?
Well, when they get that big, they push up through the leaves, and you can see them. They look like a neon light sticking out of the oak leaves, especially after they've been rained on, because mm-hmm. they get a really pretty orange. And this year, because of all the rain, they're just everywhere, under the oaks, in the poison oak, underneath the bay trees. They really like this weather, and it's a phenomenal year. Never seen it like this.
And how do you harvest them? Do you go out with a rake? I mean, you can see little lumps in the leaves where their mushrooms are coming up.
Usually just use a small stick or something. You don't want to rake it, because then you kind of disturb the area where they're growing. It's best not to disturb their area, because they grow from a mycelium that's underground. You walk gingerly, look for the bumps, but occasionally they get stepped on because you don't see them.
Did you know these mushrooms were on your property when you bought it, or is this just a big bonus?
No. Actually, we had a lot of troubles with poachers coming to take the mushrooms, so then we found out what they were after and decided that we should get the mushrooms. The ranchers should get the mushroom, not the poachers. So
now, Louis, this obviously is an ideal year for this kind of mushroom, because it's very abundant. What are ideal conditions?
Wet. Cool, wet. Mm-hmm. There have been years when the rains were warm, and a lot of them, and the mushrooms didn't do that well.
And how long will you have them?
All the way through April, possibly through the middle of May.
Okay. And they are going for $14 a pound. How do you store them?
You want to keep them in a paper bag in the refrigerator. If you're going to keep them for a long time, you might want to put a paper towel in there with the paper bag and plastic bag around the paper bag so that the moisture stays with the mushroom.
Okay. All righty. Well, Louis, this is great. These are a real treat, and everybody's lining up to get them, so we will let you keep selling. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Thank you.
That was Louis Mello, and he is fortunate enough to have these wonderful chanterelles growing wild on his property up in San Luis Obispo. We're always happy to have a chance to visit with Mark Peel, who's the owner chef at Campanile, and also the newly opened Tar Pit on La Brea. And it's called Tar Pit, and it's been open about a month and a half, mm-hmm. and we'll talk about that in a second after you help us out with a great recipe to cook these wonderful chanterelle mushrooms that we're finding that are so abundant at the markets now.
Oh, my God. This is the perfect time of year for chanterelles. With these, you want to do them as simply as possible. When you've got these big ones, I would slice them nice and thick and then simmer them just with olive oil, some sliced garlic, some fresh thyme, maybe a little pinch of rosemary. Don't overdo the rosemary. Just simmer them till they're nice and tender, and then you can slice them up. Put them with risotto, put them with chicken, serve them with potatoes. You simmer them in this little bit of broth, just water and olive oil until they're tender. And then you can take them out, kind of pat them dry, and then grill them. Don't grill them completely raw, because they'll burn, because they're so you know, so firm and so dry that they won't cook. They'll burn.
Now, these have these, the gills on the bottom, they have kind of a, they look pretty muddy. Obviously, they grow. How do you clean them without ruining them?
I would just take a paring knife and just scrape the gills. Maybe wipe it with a wet paper towel.
Okay.
And then, like I said, slice it thick. Absolutely gorgeous. I'm going to wear this as a corsage.
And they're going to be in season now. Normally, when we don't have a bumper crop here at the market, they grow everywhere. You must be so happy, though, that they're grown right here in California.
Oh, absolutely. They grow all over the place.
Yeah.
You can actually go out and find them in the San Gabriel Mountains. But I have to put in a caveat here. If you don't know what you're doing, rely on the people who do.
That's right.
Don't just go harvest mushrooms out of your front lawn.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever gone and found and harvested wild mushrooms?
You know, I've been a chef for many years. Yeah. I think I know what I'm doing, but no, I haven't.
Yeah.
It just takes one mistake. This mushrooms are the perfect expression of umami, which is that fifth sense of taste, which is savoriness, which is kind of unctuousness, which is, you know, the rich savoriness of mushrooms and meat and shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. It goes with anything.
Are they on the menu at the Tar Pit?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We're doing them with stewed chicken.
Ooh.
You know, we're making a coq au vin blanc.
Mm.
That means, you know, coq au vin is with red wine. We're doing a coq au vin blanc, which is with white wine.
And chanterelles.
And chanterelles.
Sounds fabulous. All right, now tell us again where Tar Pit is and what are its hours?
Tar Pit is on La Brea, as is Campanile. It's at 609 North. Campanile is 624 South. Tar Pit is open from 5 o'clock in the afternoon until 1:30 in the morning with food.
That was Mark Peel, chef owner at Campanile, and now chef owner at Tar Pit, also on La Brea. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures and recipes from The Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. We put everything there for you on the website so you don't have to rustle around for a pen and paper while you're driving. Sometimes Valentine's Day is a time not to just think about yourself and your immediate loved one, but to enlarge your circle and embrace people who really need you, like folks from Haiti, for example. Haitian-born Ron Duprat of Bravo's hit series Top Chef is teaming up with some fellow contestants to do a really wonderful restaurant benefit for Haiti.
This is going to work. Me and some fellow Top Chef and some famous chef across the globe, we team up together to have Heavy Hearts for Haiti, where on Valentine's Day, up to 10% of the profits will go toward Haiti.
So, for example, myself as a restaurateur, I can sign up to participate in the benefit and then let my customers know that 10% of whatever we take in on Valentine's Day will be going to the relief effort that you're organizing.
Yes. I'm working with PADF.
What is PDAF?
It's a LA-based nonprofit organization working with Jimmy Jean-Louis. He's a star in NBC Hate TV Heroes. And then I'm working with Kinship Circle. It's a disaster relief organization who's helping animals. Because, you know, in Haiti, not only the people, but the animals have been misplaced also.
Now, you come from Haiti, correct?
I was born, raised in Haiti.
So this has been a wonderful way for you to focus your need to do something.
I always think food brings people together. It's a great time for us to get together, not only as chef, as humanitarian, to give back, to do, to help for a good cause and the purpose. I'm going to go extra miles to make sure every dime goes toward Haiti. And then, you know, that's the expectations. And then hopefully in the near future, we can do more stuff for Haiti. Because now all the cameras there, everyone do a lot of stuff. But I'm hoping to be involved 110% even when CNN leaves Haiti.
Ron, when did you come to the United States? Did you come with family or did you leave on your own?
I left on my own. I come on a boat from Haiti. I was on a boat for 27 days. And I made it to Miami. I was homeless, and, you know, and I know how it is to be hungry, you know. So, you know, so I have been devoted myself to give as much I can is back.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Ron.
I'm so excited.
Find out how you can support the Hearts for Haiti benefit at kcrw.com/goodfood. Have you ever heard of the durian? It's the world's stinkiest fruit. My next guest is Nat Bletter. He's an ethnobotanist, and he recently returned from a trip to Thailand where he sampled his 250th variety of fruit.
Yeah, it was quite a momentous occasion in the middle of the forest in northeast Thailand.
What was it?
Unfortunately, the fruit doesn't have the most glorious name. It's called in Thai, Tom Lung, which sounds like something that you might hack up when you're sick with the swine flu, but it is actually pretty tasty. It's a little red berry cluster. It looks a lot like a wild cherry. And strangely enough, it's related to some of the South American fruits like soursop or guanabana or cherimoya, although it looks completely different and tastes pretty different too.
So we have to talk about the durian, I'm sure. So was this the first time you tried durian?
No. I tried durian 17 years ago for the first time in San Francisco from Chinatown there. They're usually frozen when you get them in Chinatown anywhere in the U.S., but it's still pretty pungent. And I didn't really like the first one. And so I ate a little bite of this huge fruit, and you have to tell people that this can be often bigger than a large watermelon and looking like a deadly weapon covered in half-inch long brown spikes. So I put the rest of it in the fridge, thinking maybe I'd try it again the next day. And then my roommates came back and got really angry with me the next day, and they said everything in the fridge stunk to high heaven, and we had to throw out everything.
Because durian is famously stinky.
Yeah, it's been likened to a delicious French custard run through the sewers of Paris. Pretty much any time you open up one, if people don't know the smell, they'll say that there's a gas leak in the building and you need to evacuate, which happened to us once at the Botanical Garden.
So they actually have signs at the entrance to subways, I understand, in Thailand with a picture of a durian and a line being drawn through it.
Yeah, the international symbol for forbidden. Don't bring these on planes and on a lot of hotels, too. And I'd been on a Thai Airways flight many years ago where someone brought a durian on, and I understood why they don't want them on the plane, because it was a pretty interminable 1 hour long flight.
So let's talk about some other fruit. You had a marvelous picture of a woman with this enormous jackfruit balanced on top of her head.
Oh, yeah. Those are great. The largest tree-borne fruit in the world. So the only fruit that's probably bigger are pumpkins, but they're on the ground, so they got it easy because the tree doesn't have to support them. But jackfruit can be easily over 100 pounds. And it looks sort of like a relative of the durian in that it's got this spiky covering, but not as dangerous. They also grow closer to the ground. They don't have as objectionable a smell. Some people don't like them much, but they have a very sweet smell that some people say is the taste of some chewing gums.
I heard that it was a flavoring for juicy fruit.
Yes, that's what a lot of people say, and that's when you first smell it, you're probably the thing that will come to mind first.
Now let's turn to just some, maybe not so much fruity things, but just some interesting things you encountered.
Okay.
Now there was a bowl, a picture of a bowl of a very interesting food.
I think I know what you're going to ask about.
The silkworm pupae.
Yes.
How were they prepared and what were they like?
Those were probably stir-fried, which they call pot, like pad thai, because they were kind of crispy and they were really good. They tasted a lot like peanut butter to me. It had a very rich, oily taste. I've had them before just boiled, which they do to take the silk cocoon off of them to unwind that. And so in the process of making silk, they get this delicious snack along the way. And the boiled ones just taste sort of like green beans or something. But these were much richer.
Thank you very much, Nat.
Of course. My pleasure.
Pictures of some of the fruits Nat talked about are at kcrw.com/goodfood. I wonder how many types of fruit Jonathan Gold has eaten. He's with me next, right here on Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to KCRW and KCRW.com. We're so lucky to have Jonathan Gold nearly every week on Good Food. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic for the LA Weekly. Recently, we've also had visits from his counterpart in New York, Robert Sietsema, who writes about restaurants for the Village Voice. Well, it turns out that they're friends, and today we're blessed to have them both.
Because New York is so compact compared to LA, it's easy for me to get people that want to eat out with me, and I can go and bring a big table to convene, for example, in Flushing or something. Whereas I think it's harder to get people in LA to kind of like go to some ethnic restaurant because it's like 50 miles away or whatever. I mean, it's much easier for us to – our neighborhoods are much more compact. We have now an incredible infestation of wonderful, wonderful Dong Bai restaurants that's just appeared in South Flushing. And damned if they aren't all within like three blocks of each other. So you could go to all four of them all at once if you wanted it at one time.
What is Dong Bai?
It's the three northeastern provinces of China along the Yellow Sea. And man, I would be amazed if you didn't have it in LA, because I've been sending pictures to Jonathan and he's been telling me that they seem to have a lot of those things that there already. You know, we always, when it comes to Chinese food, we used to just kind of hang our heads when it comes to comparing ourselves with LA. But now we can hold our heads high again.
Now, I guess the thing that most people would want to know is, are there certain types of food, Jonathan, that you long to see arrive here that are only in New York, and also Robert, vice versa? Robert, you go first.
I'm just ashamed at our Vietnamese restaurants compared with, you know, with those in L.A. We're catching up in terms of our Isan and other regional Thai restaurants, but in general, we lag far behind in Southeast Asian restaurants. We have no Cambodian restaurants. We have no Laotian restaurants. So when it comes to those, man, you got to go to L.A.
Well, if the restaurants are calling themselves Isan, they are probably Lao. Because even here, like at least three quarters of the Isan-style restaurants are run by Laotians trying to pass.
You know, I wondered about that because we had a dish that I always thought was Laotian, which is this kind of orange fish mousse wrapped in a banana leaf. That's not fish and mousse. That's a fish mousse, M-O-U-S-S-E. And I always thought it was Laotian, but it's been appearing in all the Isan restaurants lately.
Yeah, and that's all over Thailand. It's very similar to the Cambodian amok, which I know we used to eat together at the Cambodian restaurant in Fort Greene.
Which is now gone, of course.
Yes.
And Jonathan, is there anything that you feel you wish were here that you know you can get when you're back east?
New York is much better on Caribbean restaurants. You know, we have some Jamaican restaurants here, but nothing like the variety of them. There's one or two Trinidadian places here, and there must be 200 of them there. We have Belize.
And Barbados is another one.
Yeah, that food is so good. What was that one? Cow foot with blood pudding? That you always think is some delightful euphemism until you get it, and it's like a big cow foot in some black pudding.
Right, and that's common in the Bajan or Barbadian places like Cox, C-O-C-K, apostrophe S, which always causes tumultuous laughter.
African places are much easier to find and in much bigger variety in New York. Eastern European restaurants barely exist here. There are a couple that are actually very, very good, but not so many. And the thing that I really, really miss from New York is all the Uzbek restaurants.
I thought you were going to say that. So what I want to do now is I want Robert to describe a dish that Jonathan longs for, and then Jonathan, you torture Robert in the same way.
Wow, what fun. Crack the whip, Evan. How about the lamb tail fat kebabs at Chebrichnaya, which are cooked on this trough of lump charcoal that runs along one wall? And they're just like, the idea of eating like lamb fat may be repulsive, but these are like crisp and brown, and you eat them on a piece of bread. So,
oh, those are great. Is that the restaurant that has those strange things that look like matzahs the size of satellite dishes?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, we don't get that satellite dish matzah here.
It's actually a flatbread that's completely dry and crunchy like a matzah.
Yeah.
Yes. But the size of a giant parabolic mirror.
You could probably put it on your roof and get DirecTV. And then when you're hungry, you can take a bite of your satellite dish. It's perfect.
Now you describe a dish that would inspire longing in Robert.
Well, maybe something I had for dinner just the other night, which is the spicy dry fish kidney curry at Jelada. That they serve on this sort of hard-fried but still fluffy Thai omelet laced with herbs. The intensity of the fish kidney is such that it's almost like biting into aluminum foil, but in a good way. And the egg sort of tempers that. You'd probably like that to open up on Charles Street.
Yeah, it sounds so fantastic. I thought you were going to mention something that was Oaxacan, which is another one of the shortcomings of food here. We got plenty of stuff from Guerrero and from Puebla, but nothing from Oaxaca.
Yeah, I remember when we drove together to that restaurant you thought was Oaxacan out by Rutgers, like a million miles away from where we live. That was no more Oaxacan than Uncle Ben is my uncle.
But now I hear that a couple of Oaxacan places have closed in L.A. Is that true?
Possibly, because there's probably 100 of them. I mean, they open, they close. It's not a big deal one way or another.
This has been so much fun getting to hang out with both of you.
Thank you so much for having me, and such a treat to be with Jonathan.
Likewise.
All of Jonathan Gold's suggestions are on the Good Food Restaurant map. Find it on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. I'd love to hear from some of our New York listeners about where they like to eat. Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. You don't need to be a professional chef to make a scrumptious meal for your sweetie. Coming up, food that puts you in the mood. A special Valentine's Day menu next. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back. Time of year when thoughts turn to romance and more carnal love. Eating is a true carnal experience, so why not eat something really sexy? Amy Riley's here to encourage us to enjoy a sexy aphrodisiac menu.
Think light. Don't serve a steak because, think about it, what do you normally feel like doing after you eat a steak? Usually it's laying down. And I don't mean laying down naked with someone beside you. I mean laying down curled in the fetal position wanting to go to sleep. So I recommend when you're preparing an aphrodisiac meal that it is a lighter meal. A number of courses are great because you can tease the senses in so many ways, but each course should either be a very small portion or it should be lighter foods. I like to start any special meal with champagne. I would do a cocktail. It's called the Saffron Flirtation. And it starts with saffron that you toast a little bit so that it gets a little crunchy, and then you can grind it up into a powder. Sprinkle a pinch of saffron powder into a champagne flute, top it with champagne, and you have one of the easiest and most seductive cocktails you could ever imagine. It has this bold, robust flavor and a rich, sort of almost meaty, wild, gamey aroma, and the color is gold. That I would actually serve with one of my favorite simple fish recipes, which is a honey almond home-cured snapper. A lot of times when you make a cured fish, you'll rinse it off before you serve it. But with this one, I use a small amount of salt and then the honey and the almonds. And you don't want to rinse it off because you'll lose that sweet honey flavor. And of course, you'll send all of your delicious almonds down the drain. And your almonds have a lot of aphrodisiac and health benefits. In fact, studies have shown that nuts will help with testosterone production. I like to serve it with a little creme fraiche that I've folded lemon zest into because that hit of lemon zest kind of awakens the senses even more. For a main course for this meal, I suggest a lobster pasta with a champagne tarragon sauce. And what I like to do is use a soba noodle or a whole wheat pasta so that you're getting some fiber and some nutritional benefits from the pasta instead of just a simple sugar. Simple sugars are a little bit on the anti-aphrodisiac side because you can often get too quick of a hit of sugar and then a crash right when you're ready to do the, you know, bedroom pas de deux. So I recommend that you use a nice whole grain fiberful pasta, use a small amount, and then top it with some lobster that's been poached in a champagne butter and tarragon sauce with just a squeeze of lemon to give it a little, you know, that little citrus lift. I like to pick out dishes that kind of attract all of the senses. So colors are important. Textures are very important. Then when I finish this pasta, actually, I put a dollop of sour cream or creme fraiche on top and a little bit of flying fish roe or tobiko, which adds another layer of texture, not only just texture, but you're taking cold sour cream and putting it on top. So you have hot and cold in the same dish, and you awaken your senses even more with soft and crunchy and cold and hot. And it's much more exciting that way than just, say, serving a casserole. And then, of course, you always have to have dessert. And I like to do a dessert that could be served later. I recommend doing a very simple fruit and chocolate fondue. It's a food that you can feed each other. It's a food that you can easily make together. It's something that you can have a little now and reheat and finish later. So that would be what I would suggest as an ending to your meal and a prelude to the horizontal tango.
Amy Riley is the author of Fork Me, Spoon Me. Recipes for Amy's Valentine's menu are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Okay, so chocolate and champagne are perfect for any Valentine's celebration, or are they? I think I actually would prefer a beer, some really good bread, and some cheese. Valentine's Day is one of those holidays fraught with expectation and disappointment. I wanted to know what people really want to do on Valentine's Day, so I asked some of the staff and volunteers here at KCRW.
I never want to go out to eat on Valentine's Day because restaurants are just insane. I mean, how badly do you really want to eat out with all these other people who are just trying to impress their loved ones? So really, I'd rather just stay home and either have someone make me food or order food and have them bring it to me. I just don't want to deal with all the craziness out on the town.
All right, so no offense to my amazing child, but I'd like to have a night that's a window into my pre-motherhood days.
Valentine's Day is actually the day I met my wife, and we've been married for over 25 years now, I think going on 26. So it's a special day, and I really do enjoy going out and getting her a special arrangement of flowers.
This is Anthony Valadez, KCRW DJ. What I would like to do on Valentine's night is start a warm bubble bath for my lady, read some poetry, and then maybe break out the guitar and play some John Mayer for her. And then I just want to watch some football, maybe a basketball game, relax, maybe cuddle. Cuddling's nice.
I would give my eye teeth, actually, since I don't have a sweetheart, to just go off by myself into a zen retreat, some quiet space, and not talk for 24 hours.
On Valentine's Day, I like to sit at home, have my favorite drink, Johnny Walker Black on rocks. That's all I want for Valentine's Day.
I would just love to stay home with my girlfriend and take the time and make the dish of our dreams.
You know, restaurants, it's just a bad idea. So crowded.
The service is rushed. The food is usually subpar because the kitchen's so slammed and, you know, they run out of what you really want once you finally get the reservation.
So for Valentine's Day, I'm a total romantic. So I just envision that sunset at the beach and just the oceanfront view, the waves crashing on the rocks, maybe even coming up to the window itself as we're watching the sun setting, just eating this delicious food.
Just watch a good movie and have some chocolate.
Italian food and tiramisu.
Dinner at home with my husband that he makes.
Go where I can have a really good margarita with my Mexican food.
What do I want to do for Valentine's Day? I want to have sex.
I want to stay at home and play with our Wii with my boyfriend. That's what I would really like to do.
I'd like to have a massage on Valentine's Day.
I'd like to have someone cook for me on Valentine's Day.
I would like to go see Avatar in IMAX 3D on that Valentine's Day. A date, obviously.
I'm anti-Valentine's Day, so I really just want everyone to leave me alone and enough with the schlocky Hallmark crap.
I think what most people really want to do on Valentine's Day, get naked and have someone completely adore them. Isn't that what it's all about?
Confess to me your ideal way to celebrate Valentine's Day. Click on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Scroll all the way down to leave a comment. Tomorrow is not only Valentine's Day, it's also Tet, or Vietnamese New Year. Celebrate the Year of the Tiger next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com.
Happy New Year, everybody. This is Eddie Lin. I'm in Silver Lake at my good friend Ann Lee's house, who's also the author of the Little Saigon Cookbook. And I'm here tonight at a Tet feast. Tet is the Vietnamese New Year's, and it's similar to a Chinese New Year's in that it also falls on the lunar calendar, so it's celebrated at the same time. So how do the Vietnamese celebrate New Year's, Tet?
My parents, I was born here, I was born in the United States, but my family always talks about Tet being a 7-day experience in terms of like the marketing of the Vietnamese New Year. I think it usually goes for like 2 weeks and there's a festival down in Little Saigon. But the actual, you know, family celebration, I've only known it to be 3 days, and usually it starts with the New Year's Eve dinner. Usually we go out for that dinner, and then New Year's Day, the whole family gets together again. And we do, I don't know if you had this growing up, the little red envelopes we call Lucy. Yeah. And so basically you would go up to your elders and wish them, you know, Happy New Year, good health, good luck. And then in return, they gave you this pretty red envelope, which is now offered by Bank of America. And you put in a couple of dollars or whatever it is. And my family was cheap, so I only got a couple of dollars.
Did you know you could get red envelopes with cartoon characters on them now?
No way. What kind?
It's like Snoopy.
Like
and
Hannah Montana?
Yeah, Hannah Montana, I think, is on one of those. It's insane.
I mean, when I got them from Bank of America, that's when I'm like, oh, wow, this is like the apocalypse happening. Yeah, exactly.
Do the Vietnamese have a lot of superstitions revolving around Tet as well?
Yeah, we do. When we talk about Tet, we always call it Ang Tet, which basically means eating New Year's. So food is very much like an integral part of like the whole celebration. You're not supposed to cook. So it used to be taboo that you do anything in that 3-day period. So the food that we're having tonight is basically food that's supposed to last the entire 3 days. You always have to have ban chung and ban tet, and those are basically savory, like sticky rice dishes stuffed with like ground meat, and it's steamed and wrapped in banana leaves. It's a huge chunk of it. I always call it kind of like our fruitcakes. So they just kind of like last forever, and they never seem, you know, to go bad. But it's perfect for something like Tet because you're supposed to just lay around the house and, you know, eat what's there. And other dishes that we have, I mean, very much like braised dishes, stew dishes that you really just need to heat up.
And what's great is even those buns, we eat them in lieu of rice. So you could have that with, like, you know, your savory entrees as well. So then you don't have to cook steamed rice.
In the Chinese culture, there are interesting superstitions involving food as well. For example, the fish have to be served whole. Anything sharp, anything like a knife or scissors, are seen as to sever any good luck. And long noodles. Long noodles is another
longevity
thing.
Longevity.
Right. Mm-hmm. Represents long life, longevity.
We have, you know, fruits that are kind of kept whole. And, you know, you try to pick things where you're not, like, cutting into the food that much. Like, it's already prepared. Like, very, I don't know. I just feel like, I mean, are people just drunk and lazy the entire time? I feel like that's kind of like the MO, you know. So I think the food just kind of follows that. It's like, no cooking, drinking, hanging out.
So let's check out the food.
Well, what we have here in a clay pot, I mentioned earlier about the idea of, like, having these really braised and stewed dishes. And something that is very popular is called pit caw. Caw is a word for braised. So we have pork belly and eggs. And eggs also is another kind of, you know, I think it's very spring, like, kind of fertility. Mm-hmm. And again, keeping things round, kind of like our rounded fruit. This is amazing because you usually make a huge vat of it and it just keeps for a couple of days. So again, the idea of, like, not really cooking for the duration of the Tet time.
It smells really good.
Thank you. Another dish that I have here is also in a clay pot, and it's another braised dish, and this is prawns in a caramel sauce. It's kind of pungent right now. You know, as you know, Vietnamese food is really about our fish sauces, but that's another dish that kind of we'll stay around for a while. And then what I just kind of added here is some sauteed bok choy, and we have ginger and tofu.
And I notice you have serrano chilies in some of the dishes. Is that a normal ingredient?
I just like serrano chilies, but I mean, growing up, Little Saigon is right next to Santa Ana, which is like a large Hispanic community. So you really start to kind of see a fusion of, you know, some Mexican chilies. So, I mean, even those serrano chilies, you can actually see them in, like, herb platters. You see them at pho restaurants now. So, yeah, I mean, serrano chilies, I mean, they're really a part of Asian spices now at, like, any kind of Asian supermarket.
Now, what happens to pho during Tet? Pho is the noodle soup.
Mm-hmm. That everybody knows is kind of the gateway for a lot of people for Vietnamese food. Yeah, sometimes we'll make a big pot of pho. Pho is really great because it's another dish that, you know, can just sit on your stovetop and, you know, you can serve it up whenever you feel ready to do it.
Happy New Year. In Chinese, Xing Nian Kuai Le.
And in Vietnamese, Chúc Mừng Năm Mới.
This is Eddie Lin for Good Food.
See pictures of Ann Lee's Tet Feast at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you listen to this show frequently, you might remember that I'm a beer person. To me, there's nothing better than a bottle of Allagash White. 25 years ago, there were only a handful of breweries in the U.S., and still today, only two or three breweries control the global beer market. But beer can be so much more, says my next guest. Chris O'Brien is a beer activist, and he's raising awareness for the growing craft beer movement.
The further away we get from the food that we make and consume, the less apt we are to understand how it's made and to care about the land and the people who use the land to make our food. Beer, in my mind, is a food. When I use the term food, I'm including beer in that. So about 25 years ago, consumers, beer drinkers, people who drink beer, basically said, you know, we're not really getting what we want anymore from this handful of really what were corporate beer marketing companies, much more than they were brewers. They were companies that marketed a product. And so people said, you know, let's take this revolution back to the kitchen where all good revolutions start. Jim Hightower has a great quote about, you know, every good revolution starts in the kitchen. And that's certainly the case with beer. People went back to the kitchen and said, let's just make better beer. And not just better beer, but a better beer experience, which again has a lot to do with the people that make it and drink it. One extreme of a kind of commercial beer experience is, you know, you buy the 30-pack weekender of cheap light industrial lager and sit on the couch in front of the TV alone drinking beer, not having really a lot of fun.
How sad that image is.
Yeah. isn't it? And yet, you know, I think that's, if you look at a lot of beer marketing today, it's really the audience that they're targeting is, you know, kind of, it's a sad experience, not a jovial, convivial community experience. So what small breweries have done in America in the last 25 years is say, hey, you know, let's brew at home, let's brew small scale at the pub down the street, where as a consumer, you can walk up to the counter and you can see where the beer is made. You can talk to the man or woman making the beer, give them direct feedback, and you can talk to your friends and neighbors at the bar about a product that's made right there in front of you.
Let's talk for a minute about how actually making the beer in these small microbreweries is done in a sustainable way. Do the newer brewers that have come online in the last few years try and consciously produce their product using a more green footprint?
Absolutely. And to be honest, that's true of both the large corporate breweries as well as the small mom-and-pop type breweries. The main reason is that water is, after all, the number one ingredient by volume in beer. So brewers have to be concerned about having access to clean water, which means from an enlightened self-interest point of view, you want to protect the source of your water and you want to conserve it because you want to make sure that there's more of it to use to make more beer in the future. There are a number of breweries that have built their own wastewater treatment systems in a way that's called a living machine. It utilizes living microbes to clean the wastewater that comes out of the brewery so that the water, after being cleaned by these living microbes, is just as clean as the tap water that came into the brewery. So there's a kind of a net zero water use. They're cleaning all the water that they use, you know, so that's kind of a replenishing cycle that can go on indefinitely.
Pretty cool. Now, let's talk for a minute about localism and hops. Is there a larger movement now for breweries to grow hops where they are in the country rather than just get them all? Basically, I would imagine that most hops are grown on the West Coast.
Yeah, in fact, nearly all of the hops in America are grown in just a handful of valleys in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Within the last few years, there's been a tremendous upsurge in interest on the part of small brewers and small farmers to connect more at any level that they can, whether it's farmers who are growing barley or wheat or farmers who are growing hops. So there are now, just within the last couple of years, there are small-scale, mostly organic hop production emerging all over the country. There are some growers in Michigan and Wisconsin. There's a great, very successful project in Colorado. Many small brewers are growing a little bit of hops at their brewery, if only for decorative purposes, but it's a way of bringing a beer drinker closer to the source of the products and the land that grows the products that go into their beer. And that process, you know, once you know where things come from, you care a little bit more.
Also, I mean, I would imagine that the next step for home brewers would be to start to grow hops in their garden. It's such an absolutely beautiful plant.
It is, and a lot of people actually grow it specifically for decorative purposes. In Europe, you'll see trellises over entryways to pubs that are covered with hop vines. My next door neighbor in Washington, D.C. here grows about 8 hop vines just a little bit outside of town, and I went and helped him harvest his hops this year, and we brewed a couple batches of beer together. It just kind of removes the whole commercial side of it, and we're making and sharing beer for the experience of it and for the connection to the land and because we like good beer. And what the craft brewing renaissance in the last 25 years or so has demonstrated is that people don't want to interact with beer as a commodity. They want to interact with it as an experience with other people and something that brings them closer together. And that's what, you know, homebrew and craft beer really do well.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
Find some of Chris O'Brien's sustainable beer picks at kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, Kids in the Kitchen, raising the next generation of foodies. Stay tuned, you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. What do you call a kid who's a foodie? Well, some are calling them cooties.
I wonder if they're as annoying as the kind second grade boys and girls pass back and forth. Phil Lempert is the supermarket guru, and he has his finger on the pulse of food trends. He's here to explain this one. Are they really calling them cooties?
Well, Evan, I am. I got to tell you that I've been searching for what that right word would be that we could call this new generation of kids who really are into food. And in some cases, they're doing it themselves. If you go up on YouTube, you could find 10,000 different videos of kids where they're doing their own cooking show, their recipes, new product reviews, even helping each other figure out what to eat from a nutritional standpoint. So we've coined the phrase cooties, that we're actually creating a social network for them and just being able to communicate how important food is and food preparation is to the next generation. Frankly, and you and I have talked about this before, one of the problems that I think we have when it comes to obesity and health is people don't relate to food. They don't know what food is really supposed to taste like. So if we could get this new generation to be cooties, can you imagine the power that food will have in 10 or 20 years when these cooties become the CEOs of food companies and chefs and just be leading the country? It will be great.
They're really amazing because this whole generation of children now, a lot of them have been exposed to so much stuff at such an early age. And they really are very sophisticated about what they want to put in their mouth, and they know a lot. Do you think that this is just an urban trend?
I hope not. You know, what we've seen, and I've seen the exact same thing that you are talking about, what we've also seen are a bunch of books that have come out on trying to, you know, hide healthy foods from your kids, you know, put celery and peanut butter and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's the wrong message to put out. What you're talking about is exactly what we need. In order for these kids to develop the right palate, to really get a good relationship with their food, we need to be teaching them. And frankly, I've seen some kids that have better palates than the adults do.
Do you think they have an impact on buying patterns of their parents?
Definitely. The same way that when we were kids, we would impact, you know, what breakfast cereal we wanted from our parents. These kids are doing the same exact thing. And the difference is that this generation versus probably a generation ago, they love to go supermarket shopping with their parents. And it's not about, oh, you know, get this candy or get, you know, this breakfast cereal. It's really about different produce. It's about different ingredients. I think we're really on the cusp of a fabulous trend when it comes to the food world.
Well, thank you very much, Phil.
Thank you, Evan.
Phil Lempert is the supermarket guru. Find out more about cooties at kcrw.com/goodfood. See some videos of these pint-sized gourmands there, too. Where to go on a first date in Los Angeles? That's the question. And for the answer, we turn to Leslie Bala of Tasting Table LA. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Evan.
You know, Angeli, my place, has been the scene of probably a million first dates. So I always find it very interesting that that the process of picking a first date place is kind of fraught.
I think there's a really good difference between date restaurants and romantic restaurants. Like you said, your restaurant is, I think it's a great first date place. There's conversation. It's not too loud where you can't hear anybody. The servers aren't in your face. Everybody's very personable. The food's great. It's simple. It's classic. It just fits. And therefore, you don't have to think about anything else. You can just kind of focus on each other and a great piece of bread right out of the oven in front of you.
Thank you. I think one of the key things would be that you don't want to go anywhere where you feel like you're not hip enough to measure up.
That can definitely be an issue. But, you know, sometimes that's really what people want. Maybe buzzy, not necessarily trendy, but kind of a good hipster place would be, I think, this new restaurant called The Mercantile in Hollywood. It's not necessarily hipster per se, but it has this kind of old West kind of Olson's Little House on the Prairie with Hollywood hipster mixed in.
I love that.
It's really great. It's really relatively new. It has really high ceilings and this blue and white floral wallpaper. And during the day, it's a gourmet market and deli. at night, the lights get dimmed. There's this really nice long bar. There's this upstairs little dining area nook that you can sit in if you want. Otherwise, these huge windows with all the lights from outside and, you know, some nice jazz in the background, and you can share a pot of fondue, drink these great wines. I actually think it was really romantic. We shared a carafe of wine and chicken pot pie, even tuna noodle casserole. It's so good there.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. I have to try that. Where else is good?
Well, I also like Labuca. I love Osteria Labuca. I think it's, again, it comes back to this homey, kind of comfortable room. All the servers with their Italian accents, they're not aggressive by any means. A great comforting bowl of pasta. There's the upstairs with the new, you know, they renovated in the last couple of years and they opened, they've expanded. So there's this upstairs room that has a fireplace, and that can actually be kind of romantic, a little bit more intimate. It's definitely a lot quieter up there than it is downstairs. But, you know, again, I don't know what it is about Italian food and great first dates. I think it's just one of those things probably everybody can agree on. There's this other new place in Pasadena that I just recently went to called Noir Bar. If you're familiar with Pasadena, it's on this little street near Lake and Colorado next to the Ice House Comedy Club. Tiny little space. It's so charming. I mean, small, little intimate dining room. But what I liked, they have this narrow patio on the side and they have these wrought iron arches that go over top. And I was there last week when there was a full moon, and the full moon was shining right down into the patio. And it was, we were sharing different plates of food, and you can get a flight of wine or you can get a bottle of wine, just a lot of sharing. And I was just with one of my friends and we were like, this would be a great place for a date because you can talk and it's, again, just kind of comfortable and, you know, the right night, it can be absolutely perfect.
Sounds wonderful.
Another place that I think is really kind of cool is Chemo on Fairfax. It's one of those places that you can go in and even if it's crowded, which, you know, maybe today, these days, it's not as crowded. But the last time I went, all the tables were taken, but they had couples in some of those really big booths were just sharing a table and, you know, share a tagine. And
because Chemo is a North African restaurant.
Yeah, this Moroccan, and then with California influences. So it's these really wonderful flavors and spices, but again, it's approachable food that wouldn't turn, you know, people off. But I think it's kind of this hidden, especially if people are used to going out a lot. It's great to go somewhere where maybe they won't recognize anybody. They don't need to be seen. They can kind of tuck away and just focus on their date.
Yeah, absolutely. It's on a block that you wouldn't expect anything special.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
Then there's the romantic side of things. Now, this is maybe not necessarily for the first date, or if you really wanted to impress somebody on a first date, or maybe people don't like the more bustling kind of, you know, low-key vibe like those other spots. There are some white tablecloth restaurants in town that are still some of the, I think, unexpected gems for a romantic night out. One downtown is Drago Centro. It's right there in City National Plaza. This is Celestino Drago's newest restaurant. It's big. It's pretty. All these lovely, you know, chandeliers and gorgeous wallpapers and smooth, creamy leather furniture and beautiful wine storage right in the middle of the room. This is elegant. In the daytime, very business-oriented. It's right there at City National Plaza. Lots of suits, lots of business lunches. But at night, again, I think
definitely, it transforms it
really,
at night.
It really does. So you're either going to places like Church and State that are really loud and bustling and just kind of energetic, or you can find this, you know, places like this where the windows look out in that beautiful orange sculpture into the plaza, the libraries across the street, they're big, tall skyscrapers, you know, buildings around you. You forget you're in Los Angeles. This is a downtown city center that I think not a lot of people remember we actually have. And at night, I'm serious, the service is amazing. The wine list is impeccable. You know, this is definitely not your inexpensive meal, but wonderful food. You can get a really lovely veal chop there, and it's just really great. I think service is really key to those experiences. You definitely don't want people to bother you if you're on a first date. You want to be able to talk to this person you're with. A really great service will be able to read if the first date's going bad or good, too, and they can actually help. And, you know, there are definitely some people out there who are fantastic. It's a lot of these places that I've already talked about.
Give us another white table place.
Well, there are a couple. I think that Ortolan has this gorgeous decor that just screams romance.
And where is that?
That is on 3rd Street. This is Christophe Aimé's restaurant, French restaurant. again, these gorgeous chandeliers. The decor just screams romance. And this is another, dress to impress kind of place. You kind of want to dress up when you go there because it's so pretty. And his food has kind of a suppleness to it and this also kind of aroma. And some of it, like, his scrambled eggs that are served in the eggshell with caviar. And I think even like his scallops with pumpkin ravioli. I don't know. There's just this kind of softness to all of those things that just, you want a glass of champagne and just a toast whoever you're with. And I also think that Vibrato up in Beverly Glen, this is Herb Alpert's restaurant and the Smith brothers who own a lot of restaurants in Pasadena.
Is this in the center?
It is. Yes. So it's hidden. And I think people who live around there are used to dining in those restaurants. But if you don't live in Bel Air or Brentwood, you're not always going up there. When you walk in, it sounds like the studio. It's all the elements that they used in the decor were meant for live performance. So you go here, you can even sit at the bar, have a nibble and listen to some live jazz, or sit at a table and they have great steaks and seafood, kind of the steakhouse fare. Again, this is kind of I'm going to impress the person that I'm with and we're going to hear, especially for music lovers.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. And then my final one, I think, would be one of my favorite places to end a night. And I think it's kind of sophisticated without having to be dressed up or anything, is to go to Luke, sit at the bar, fireplace right there for dessert and an after dinner drink. I think it's wonderful.
It's really wonderful.
That's it. I mean, it's also great for dinner as well. I think the patio is super, super charming. And those trees that have grown over 10 years, and all the ivy on the wall, it's really lovely. But I do love to sit at the bar and just, that's a great place to end a night.
Thank you, Leslie.
Sure, no problem. Thank you.
That was Leslie Bala. She comes to us from Tasting Table. We've been talking about places for casual dates or romantic evenings. You can read her list at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can podcast or download the show, find photos, links, and info on all of our guests at kcrw.com/goodfood. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Ells produced and edited the program with help from Bob Carlson, Candace Moore, Jillian Ferguson, and Holly Carson. Gary Masiha chooses all of our music. Thanks to Darby Maloney, too. There's more Good Food on our blog. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to find it. I'm Evan Kleinman. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.